Perfect grammar, persistent, continuous, sustained, is the fourth dimension, so to speak. Many have sought it, but none has found it. Even this reviewer, this patriot with all his godless airs, has made two or three slips. At least I think he has. I'm almost sure by witness of my ear, but cannot be positive, for I know grammar by ear only, not by note, not by the rules. This reviewer even seems to know, or seems even to know, or seems to know even, how to put the word even in the right place, and the word only, too. I do not like that kind of person. I never knew one of them that came to any good. In his newly published autobiography, Mark Twain tells of grappling with grammar, although he did have a keen ear for standard and colloquial English. And compared to much of the writing that we see in the American media today, Twain's English has the correctness worthy of Oxford. But what good is grammar in this age of instant mass communication? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is the University of the Air.
Who cares if it's lie or lay, or if impact becomes a verb? After all, who's the boss here? Is grammar supposed to tell us how to speak and write? Or is its role simply to describe how we communicate? Assuming that there are rules, shouldn't they change every day as our use of the English language changes? Our guest with the answers is David Mulroy, professor of classics at the UW-Milwaukee, and he just shared his new translation of Oedipus Rex with us, and now he's here to enlighten us about grammar, and he's the author of the 2003 book, The War Against Grammar.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you, Emily. I'm very happy to be here, Norman.
Well, let's start with your title, The War Against Grammar. That implies that there's a war going on. What made you pick that title, and what are you referring to?
Well, the origin of the book is that for years I taught Latin at UW-Milwaukee, and found that most students couldn't succeed in learning Latin. And the reason was obvious to me, namely that they had never learned basic English grammatical concepts. They didn't know the parts of speech, and they couldn't diagram a sentence, to save their lives. So I think it was in 1996, Wisconsin was formulating new academic standards. And I attended a public meeting in which I said I thought it would be good if high school graduates could identify the parts of speech in normal prose. I thought this was a very modest suggestion that everybody would immediately endorse. But to my surprise, I found that it ran counter to conventional wisdom among K-12 educators. And I was given a copy of a publication by the National Council of Teachers of English announcing that years of research had proven that instruction, formal instruction in English grammar, was not only useless, but actually counterproductive in terms of improving students' writings.
Was so that declaration grammatical?
The declaration itself was, yes.
Why would anyone be opposed to students learning the parts of speech, like nouns and verbs and so on? That seems pretty basic.
Well, right, but the theory is that such instruction confuses students and makes them fearful of making mistakes and destroys their spontaneity, and that the students don't ever really master the material anyway, and it takes time away from meaningful activities. It's an outgrowth of progressive education. It's an outgrowth of the belief that all education, or as much as conceivably possible, should consist of meaningful activities rather than instruction in isolated topics.
You've got a joke that you quote in your book about a way of demonstrating the shift in thinking about this. In this case, it's actually sort of a math problem, but it goes like this. 10 years ago, middle school students were given the following problem. A lumberjack cut down a tree and sold it for $1,000. His expenses were 10%. How much money did he make? And then 5 years ago, you say the problem was revised this way. A lumberjack cut down a tree and sold it for $1,000. His expenses were $100. How much money did he make? And then you say last year, the problem was simplified again. A lumberjack cut down a tree and killed a spotted owl. How do you feel about this?
Well, there's a little bit of that involved, too. That's right.
Well, I have to say that, you know, going through Wisconsin schools myself, I feel cheated by the fact that I never was given formal instruction in grammar. Mm. And as an English professor, it's sometimes been embarrassing because I don't have a solid background in the different kinds of clauses and prepositional phrases and all that sort of thing. It's been kind of an ad lib process to get it. And I think it was because teachers were, again, trying to nurture the creativity, trying to separate out the part of literature from the part of grammar, because it's always linked together in a kind of strange way.
That's right. The study of grammar was begun historically in order to secure the understanding of older classical texts. So the study of grammar and literature has always been linked. And when the study of literature runs into hard times, so does the study of grammar. This is a historical process that lies behind the Renaissance, actually. In the High Middle Ages, the study of literature and the study of grammar were both abandoned for the study of pure logic and disputations. But it was only after a century or so of that kind of arid scholasticism that the humanists of the Renaissance returned to the study of literature. But as a foundation for that, they reestablished the importance of grammar. So, well, right, the study of literature and grammar is linked.
So that makes a distinction between the written word and the spoken word, though. I mean,
yes,
if we go back to the Renaissance when grammar had fashion, and even to the classics, I guess, in antiquity, grammar had value. Was there a distinction made between written grammar and conversation?
Well, yes. It was understood that grammar applied chiefly to written classics of literature. Well, if you go back to antiquity, when education was first formalized, the foundational subjects were the seven liberal arts, the trivium and the quadrivium, and grammar was the first of the seven liberal arts. But its purpose was to interpret written literary classics, and that remained true for centuries. Grammar was somewhat abandoned in the High Middle Ages. In the Renaissance, when people returned to grammar, Latin was no longer a vernacular language. But the primary goal of grammar was to learn how to read classical Latin. So the Renaissance grammars used vernacular languages to explain the grammar of Latin. This happened in English, Spanish, Italian, German, uniformly across Europe. The result was that native speakers of English, for example, for the first time began to understand English grammatically because they were given examples in English of the constructions that they were supposed to learn in Latin. And this resulted in a great improvement in the way that English was not only spoken but written.
You have at the beginning of your first chapter a quote from the writer David Foster Wallace writing in Harper's Magazine. I'm going to read that and ask you to comment because I think it's pretty concrete. I teach college English part-time, mostly literature, not composition. But I'm also so pathologically anal about usage that every semester the same thing happens. The minute I have read my students' first set of papers, we immediately abandon the regular literature syllabus and have a 3-week emergency remedial usage unit during which my demeanor is basically that of somebody teaching HIV prevention to intravenous drug users. When it emerges, as it does every time, that 95% of these intelligent upscale college students have never been taught, for example, what a clause is or why a misplaced only can make a sentence confusing, I all but pound my head on the blackboard. I exhort them to sue their hometown school boards.
Right, right. Well, this is a pretty common experience. Teachers in college discover their students are amazingly ignorant when it comes to grammar and also resistant to instruction in grammar. And so the effort is made to teach composition, to teach foreign language, and so forth, to teach reading comprehension without utilizing grammar, since the students are so resistant to it. Mr. Wallace doesn't say how his experiments turned out, but I suspect that he probably didn't really succeed ever in giving his students a really good grasp of grammar in his emergency sessions.
Because it was too late, or because it wasn't enough time, or what?
I think you could say it's too late. I talk about my own failure in trying to teach grammar to college students. I taught, I think, three separate freshman seminars aimed at just teaching the fundamentals of English grammar to college freshmen. And I would say that none of those classes succeeded. And the students were just extremely resistant. I say in my book it was like trying to teach table manners to a motorcycle gang. They just didn't want to learn grammar. And I think they felt that it was beneath them. And also their teachers had told them that it was unnecessary. And they felt also that it was an assault on the way they spoke English. And it's just very hard to get around those attitudes.
What exactly, how would you define grammar?
Well, I think to me grammar chiefly consists of the ground rules of forming a sentence. The rules and the concepts that enable you to create a declarative sentence or a question or a command.
And say what you mean.
And say what you mean. A lot of emphasis is given to prescriptive grammar, obeying rules, or not saying ain't, or making the subject and the verb agree, or saying between you and me instead of between you and I, things like that. To me, that's not the most important aspect of grammar. It does make a bad impression to make grammatical errors in conversation. But to me, the essential educational value is understanding the rules and concepts in general terms by which sentences are constructed. So it's so basic. A declarative sentence was defined by Aristotle as a group of words that is accompanied by truth or falsehood. If you think about it, you can't say anything that's true or false. You can't even think anything that's true or false except by constructing a declarative sentence, at least in your own mind. So it's these rules and concepts, the parts of speech, subject, predicate, and so forth, the different types of verb clauses, dependent clauses, these are at the heart of human consciousness. And it seems just so obvious to me that it's an advantage to have a conscious understanding of how our minds work in that respect.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for
sure.
A minute, just, since there are a lot of people who come out against the formal teaching of grammar. Let's say that, we, so far as we've been talking to mm-hmm. you, have done absolutely fine asking questions
and
hearing your
yes.
answers. We haven't then had to go back and think, oh, well, that was a prepositional phrase, and oh, that was the verb to be, and I just use an adjective. So let's say I take a sentence like, I am tall.
Mm-hmm.
It's a falsehood, but let's pretend it's true.
Right.
I am tall. Why do I need to know? What good is it for me to know that that's a subject, a verb, and an adjective? Why, since I know what I mean and you know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
why would it be of any use?
Oh, well, I think it only becomes useful with more complicated challenges. You don't need to know grammar to make, short, informal utterances intelligibly. I think that a grasp of grammar, in my opinion, is essential for reading comprehension when complex sentences are involved, and also for internalizing the rules of a foreign language for foreign language study, and also probably for English composition. I mean, that it enables you to create much larger structures than you could otherwise create.
Well, English has, I suppose, like any language, some pitfalls, too. And if you don't use it right, you're not saying what you intend to say. I mean, the classic is the misplaced modifier.
Mm-hmm.
The flowers were enjoyed by the people blooming in the park.
Yes.
That kind of thing.
The
people do talk that way, and that's not what they mean.
Uh-huh. Right. This is true. Although errors in comprehension and conversation don't seem so serious to me. The most shocking thing I ran across in doing research for this book was a test that I myself gave to students who had not been trained in grammar, having to do with reading comprehension. What I did was give them the first sentence of the Declaration of Independence without telling them what it was. The sentence begins, "When in the course of human events," and so forth. It's a long sentence introduced by a complex dependent clause. And I asked them simply to paraphrase the meaning of what was said. And a little less than half got close enough to the meaning for me to say that they were correct.
Can you read the actual Declaration of Independence sentence and then a few examples of the not-so-good paraphrases?
Yeah, I'd like to, yeah. "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth a separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation." So I was just looking for a paraphrase that said that when people break up a political union, they should explain why. You know.
Right. But, of course, there are certain – it's not a legal document per se, but it is written by – people who have to bear law in mind, and so they have to pack in a lot of information.
There's quite a bit of information there, but it's all grammatically arranged. There are certainly no grammatical errors in it. But. So I asked the students to paraphrase, and the most interesting, in a way, funny but also upsetting were the students that thought they understood it perfectly well and gave paraphrases like this. "When dealing with events in life, one should drop preconceived knowings and assume that everything that happens happens for a reason. And basically, life goes on."
Oh, so there's no need to have a revolution, in other words. Well, and you have to wonder, is that the kind of person you would want operating on your brain 10 years, 20 years from now?
I think I see what you're saying, though, is that if we don't have the ability to understand the grammar of a sentence, it may mean we also don't understand its meaning. If we don't know its meaning, we're really operating at a loss.
That's right. I think that the formal study of grammar is necessary for reading comprehension if we want to include works of literature of you know, some
but,
complexity.
But how would it help with that actual sentence, the "when in the course of human"? I mean, how would the knowledge of the grammar rules help you crack open what seems like a clause-heavy, you know, older sentence?
Well, one of the most important concepts in grammar is the clause. That's what Wallace says. Students don't know what a clause is. And he's right. As a general rule, students haven't been. And you have main clauses and dependent clauses. So that if you're schooled in grammar, the first word, "when," is a major road sign saying this is the beginning of a dependent clause. This is not the main clause of the sentence. And so all that follows until you get to the comma, you know, is subordinated, and you know you haven't gotten to the main point yet. And then you get "a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires." That's the main clause. So when you're asked what does the whole thing mean, you focus on the subject and the main clause, and then "requires" is itself followed by a noun clause, requires that they should declare the causes. So the sentence viewed grammatically is a pretty transparent structure if you have a good grasp of the concept of dependent clauses and subjects and you know.
It helps
and
to
so forth.
Prioritize the parts of the sentence and then get to the meaning of it that way.
And right, and you, if you're not trained in grammar, I think you think of a sentence as being about the length of a breath, and you know after a certain length, that's a sentence, and then you know another sentence is going to start, and that confuses people. I ran across another example of that phenomenon. I was thinking about the difficulty that people have with the words of the Star Spangled Banner, and it seemed to me that this is another case of clauses, dependent clauses, causing confusion. Now, I'm talking about the first stanza of the first sentence. "Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed?" That's relative clause number one.
Mm-hmm.
"By the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars?" That's relative clause number two, the banner whose broad stripes and bright stars, or the ramparts we watched, that's clause number three, or the ramparts that we watched were so gallantly streaming. So I thought this is a dramatic example of when Christina Aguilera messed up the words.
She's not the first.
By no means the first. So many people have trouble with it. And I think that it's the proliferation of relative clauses that give people a problem. But I ran across what seemed to me to be proof of that theory. Looking at the lyrics of the Star Spangled Banner on the internet, I found that more recent versions of them make that relative clause, whose broad stripes and bright stars, a separate question.
Really? I think that would make it harder to understand, wouldn't it? By breaking it up.
They break it up into shorter... Mm-hmm. Yeah, they break it up into shorter units. Let's see. Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hail by the twilight's last gleaming? Whose broad stripes and bright stars? That's how it's interpreted. Just to be sure, it's so wonderful, the things you get from the internet. You can instantly access a copy of Francis Scott Key's own handwritten version of, and sure enough, there's a comma after the first one. It's all one sentence in his intention. But I think I attribute this to the lack of grammatical understanding that has been broken up and made incoherent. It doesn't make any sense as a separate question. Whose broad stripes?
Hard to sing, too.
That's right.
The war against grammar when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest is David Mulroy, and we're looking at grammar, which can be a pretty contentious topic, as it turns out, and has been over the years. At what point, though, if we look at writings of, let's say, English authors, at what point do we see grammar actually becoming an issue? I mean, if you read Chaucer, for example, of course, who can tell whether he's using good grammar or not without being a scholar of Middle English? But where does it really seem to become an issue?
Well, it became an issue in the 1300s and the 14th century. It's really entangled with the beginning of the Renaissance. This was the most interesting single thing that I learned in researching my book about grammar, that as I think I mentioned earlier, in the High Middle Ages, grammar had been marginalized, and conservative educators complained vociferously that their students didn't even know the parts of speech. So they sound just like college teachers today. Yeah. They sound like, the things that Wallace says could have been said in the 13th century. And it was... especially Petrarch in Italy and, you know, his followers and people he influenced, who made a return to the study of what they called the humanities, by which they meant literature, moral philosophy, and so forth, but all grounded first in a return to the study of Latin classics and the study of grammar. So their educational program was rooted in attention to grammar in what we would call grade school. And in one country after another, reforms were made to redirect younger students to the study of the parts of speech and so forth, conjugation, declension, aimed at learning Latin, but having the side benefit of understanding the grammar of their own vernacular languages, because in the education reforms, the grammar was taught in terms of vernacular languages. So this reform gradually made its way north and west until it came to England about 1500. It was brought there through the influence of Erasmus. And King Henry VIII decreed that all the students in his realm were to learn this study grammar, study Latin grammar, and even prescribed the textbook, Lilly's Grammar, which henceforth all English students had to learn, and basically meant mastering the parts of speech and so on and so forth.
Was that part of sort of this Renaissance spirit?
Well, yeah, it was right. It's really at the foundation of the Renaissance spirit. It all starts with learning grammar well, and then you go on to studying the classics of literature.
With some underpinnings of nationalism, sounds like. The emphasis to learn your native language, your vernacular language, through this.
Originally that was pragmatic. In the High Middle Ages, students learned Latin largely by immersion. A great emphasis was placed on what is today called communicative competence. If you could get your thought across, that was good enough. You didn't have to use absolutely the right case ending. And so you have these people that had a kind of a superficial fluency in conversational Latin. That was the typical student, but who couldn't read, Virgil or whatever. So the educators of the early Renaissance wanted to make sure that their students actually understood Latin grammar. And so to do that, they explained it in terms of, in England, in terms of English. And that had the side benefit that the students for the first time began to think of their own language as having a grammar. Before that, it was thought that only Latin had grammar, and other languages were just,
I am beginning to think, maybe there was a real reason why Henry had Anne Boleyn's head cut off. Maybe she said, I'm going to lay down one too many times.
That's right. Yeah.
Where does Shakespeare fit into the story?
Well, Shakespeare, for a couple of centuries before the 1500s, there were no great literary artists in England. There's Chaucer, and there's a kind of a long, long desert with no outstanding literary artists. But then the students who were trained in Lilly's grammar, who benefited from Henry VIII's educational reforms, became active. And people like Spenser, Marlowe, so there's a whole list of the English Renaissance artists topped by William Shakespeare. And the evidence is quite clear that William Shakespeare learned Latin through Lilly's grammar, the grammar that had been enforced by Henry VIII. So I like to say that in advocating a return to grammar as an academic reform, that this earlier version of it gave us William Shakespeare, which seems to me to be pretty good evidence of the benefits of studying.
Pretty good deal. I'm trying to think through Shakespeare's works, if other than foreigners, there are characters who use bad grammar as a way of character illustration, Bottom the Weaver or some other rustic.
No, there is, however, a joke in the Merry Wives of Windsor about the grammar textbook that he used. It's a reference to it. It's a sort of obscure joke, but you have these different cases in Latin.
Yes.
And one of them is the vocative case.
Oh, that's right. Oh, God.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God. Okay. Mm-hmm. And Lilly's grammar uses the adjective meaning this, hic, hic, hoc,
right,
to illustrate all the different case endings. But this doesn't have a vocative form because you never say, this man. Okay, so it's a pretty complicated joke. But in The Merry Wives of Windsor, there's a fatuous parson who's drilling a student and asks him to give the different case endings of hic, and he asks him what the vocative is, and the student doesn't know. And the parson says, it's caret. That's a Latin joke. Caret means it is missing.
Oh.
And that's how it's, that's a direct quotation from Lilly's grammar.
That's a pretty inside joke.
It's an inside joke. Then.
Well, but at least the literate among Shakespeare's audience would have gotten it.
Well, that's right. All the people that study Lilly's grammar instantly chortled.
So would you argue then that Shakespeare's command of grammar, his understanding of it, would have given him the ability to use language, sentences, lines, both poetic and also in prose, in more complex fluent ways?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I think it was Samuel Johnson, I'm not sure, but one admirer of Shakespeare said that he learned enough Latin to grammaticize his English. And you can illustrate that easily.
The thing about Shakespeare, which is also intriguing now that I think about it, is It's grammatical and all that, but still these are lines that have to be said by characters and make sense to an audience who's hearing it just once through. So I suppose if you're going to communicate these fairly complex ideas, which Shakespeare's characters do, they've got to be quite clear grammatically, logically, in what they're saying.
Oh, that's right. And they are. But it makes you think that his audience must have had a fairly good comprehension of grammar, though, because they're so complex. I would, you know, hate to think what the students who struggled with the first sentence of the Declaration of Independence make of some of Shakespeare's poems.
So by the time we get to Shakespeare, we have English grammar pretty well entrenched and what we would call a prescriptive grammar, saying you will follow these rules if you're going to write proper, clear English?
No. What became entrenched was the importance of learning grammar, especially Latin grammar, in early education. The first of the liberal arts, grammar, was restored to its prestigious position. And England started having grammar schools. But the grammar that students learn in a precise way was the grammar of Latin. It was some time before they also gained a conceptual understanding of the structure of English. But as far as speaking correct English goes, that was another development. I think in Shakespeare's day and beyond, there's quite a bit of diversity in the way people speak English and what's considered correct, and quite a bit of regional diversity.
What about some rules that we're told, but a lot of people don't follow? For example, split infinitives.
Oh, right. Oh, that's a famous, yeah.
That you're not supposed to say to greedily eat. You're supposed to say to eat greedily, and not split up the two from the verb. Where would a rule like that come from, and for what reason? Who decided that was a rule?
It's never actually been a rule. It's a rule that's, in the reading that I did, is cited most often by opponents of grammatical prescriptivism as a ridiculous rule that's promoted by old-fashioned prescriptivists. But it's impossible to find an old-fashioned prescriptivist who actually promotes the rule. So it's a kind of an illusion. The proprieties of English, I guess, were established most famously in the 18th century in America by an author named Robert Loth, who laid out the rules of proper English. And this was part of a general effort in the 18th century to create standard languages. And he laid out prescriptive rules. Most of them are just common sense, are the conjugation of English verbs, the different meaning of tenses and things like that. Modern writers who are opposed to prescriptivism, as they call it, blame people like Loth for promulgating these ridiculous rules. But the fact is that he didn't. There was a 19th century author that I found who was the first person that mentioned the split infinitive and said that it was something that that he thought was avoided by English writers. And he was pretty much right. Up to that time, split infinitives had been generally avoided. They've become more frequent in recent years. But there's no reputable expert that ever said you shouldn't split an infinitive.
What about the not ending a sentence with a preposition? Same thing.
Same thing with prepositions, yeah.
Well, of course, Churchill had a famous response,
right,
now, this is something up with which I shall not put.
That's right, yes.
Well, let me ask you this. What are some of the most egregious offenses that you encounter on a daily basis in terms of violating grammar rules?
Yeah. Well, as I said, I'm not a prescriptivist by temperament. Grammatical mistakes, for the most part, don't really bother me. What bothers me is the underlying ignorance of grammatical concepts. So between you and I bothers me. But it's because it's a clear indication that the speaker does not know that I is the form that's used when it's the subject of the sentence and me is the correct form to use in all other cases. The prevalence of lay for lie also bothers me. And for much the same reason, the distinction is pretty easy. Lay is a transitive verb. It takes a direct object, and lie is intransitive.
In other words, I will lay the book on the table, but I will lie down.
Exactly, exactly. So that's an important distinction between transitive and intransitive verbs. It's pervades the language, and it's a very nice organizing principle. So, yeah, when I hear somebody say, I was laying in the sun, it bothers me because it's a way of saying I don't know the difference between transitive and intransitive.
And you
verbs,
see that in some fairly, I'll say, high places. I've seen it in an Associated Press story.
Mm-hmm.
That's that common. On the other hand, of course—
Yeah, well, I was going to say that eventually it seems like lay is going to displace lie, and, it's a matter of decades, it'll be perfectly correct to say I lay in the sun.
Well, and that gets us back into that notion of grammar as not prescription, but just as a description of the path that the language is taking, because obviously it has changed considerably, say, since Shakespeare's time.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And breaking rules of grammar or perceived rules of grammar all along the way. But then there's at some point in your own lifetime when you become unintelligible,
if you ignore them. Well, I don't know. What seems to me to get lost in discussions like this is the fact that all of grammar is nothing but arbitrary rules. Just in English, the fact that you put the subject first and the object after the verb, that's just an arbitrary rule that, if you
provides
want—
provides consistency.
That you have to obey if you want to be understood. So there are some rules that are sort of marginal, but they're all part of the same package of rules. And the rules change. And there's no reason to, resist the gradual change in the language. However, it should be pointed out that the prescriptivists, the grammarians like Loth, that tried to spell out the rules of grammar and gave us a model for standard English, really achieved a wonderful thing, namely the creation of standard English, so that people all over the world, from New Zealand, Australia, England, the United States, Canada, we all communicate effortlessly because we were given this model to adhere to and because we have an educational system that spread it.
People from Russia or Italy who are learning English.
Need
some kind of structure to work with. Yeah.
Recently, I had one of my UW Odyssey students working on a passage from Macbeth because I had them memorize some lines from Macbeth, and she was struck by the line, "He do bleed," and thought it sounded like Ebonics.
Uh-huh.
Can you say something about the place of dialects, non-standard English? If you get to an author like Toni Morrison, there are multiple grammars being used.
Sure, sure.
Or Mark Twain.
Mm-hmm. Mark Twain, yeah. Well, right. I mean, that's an issue that you encounter when you talk about grammar. And you're always exhorted to be a sensitive, not to imply that English is somehow superior to lesser languages. And that of course, is true. This linguist, Steven Pinker, has the quotation that a standard language is nothing but a dialect with an army and a navy.
That's interesting.
Interesting and pithy, but it isn't true, first of all. Latin was a standard language after the conquest by the German barbarians, to pick one example. What's left unstated when you make the case that the dialects are just as good as standard languages, what's left out is that standard languages have dictionaries and encyclopedias and grammars and the classical literature and systems of education.
Numbers of followers, usually.
Well, yes, and a huge number of followers. The existence of dictionaries gives them a huge advantage in the size of the vocabulary and so forth. And the effort at standardization, some standard languages have academies. So all of those things are real advantages, so that when you learn a standard language, you really have something that, from a pragmatic point of view, is much better than a dialect. The utility of knowing a dialect is limited by those those factual circumstances.
That's why Latin, I suppose, was so useful for so long for so many people, because being a dead and unchanging language, it was totally consistent for hundreds of years.
Well, there is that. That's true, yeah.
Great scientific language and international language for a long time.
It illustrated the value of having a standard language. And then there was a great development when the vernacular languages became also standard languages and developed also their own grammars and dictionaries and literatures.
I think Mark Twain said that the reason Latin was a dead language is only the dead have time to learn it. More on the war against grammar when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Sentences always have and always will consist of clauses with subjects and predicates, and of words that fall into classes fairly well described as verbs, nouns, adjectives, adverbs, pronouns, prepositions, conjunctions, and interjections. Individuals who understand these concepts have a distinct advantage over others where the use of language is involved, and that means everywhere. If only for the purpose of helping disadvantaged students, it should therefore be a high priority for all English teachers to find ways to deliver effective formal instruction in grammar in the middle grades of all schools, not just elite ones. There is reason to believe that this change of policy would also increase our nation's appreciation of its literary heritage, promote the study of foreign language, and improve the quality of the spoken and written discourse in which we are all immersed.
That's the final paragraph of the book, The War Against Grammar, by our guest, David Mulroy. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Well, if you could recommend changes or point to areas where you've seen a return in instruction in grammar where it leads to some kind of result, what would you include?
Well, as far as changes go, the biggest, most important change would be that states required teachers who are being certified to teach English to have a thorough grasp of the concepts of basic grammar, sentence-level grammar, parts of speech, sentence diagramming, and so forth, and be encouraged to teach those concepts aggressively in the early grades. Teach them in isolation, if you will.
They do call it grammar school still, after all.
They still do. And a return to that tradition would be just wonderful. It does, it hasn't vanished completely. In writing the book, I visited some wonderful schools where in the grades, sentence diagramming and parts of speech and so forth was a major subject. The most memorable one was nearby in the Brookfield Academy. There, students in studying grammar, there's a big emphasis on sentence diagrams. And one exercise they do, which they love, is you put a sentence diagram on the board, and the students are allowed to make up sentences that correspond to the diagram that are gross. They're allowed to be gross. So I was invited to, you know, give them a challenge. I said I wanted a linking sentence whose subject was a gerund with a direct object. Linking sentence, gerund, direct object. Immediately every hand in the class shot up. I called in one little boy who said, "Spewing chunks is unpleasant," which is a perfect example.
Yeah. So grammatical grossness.
Grammatical grossness. I dedicated the book to him. I thought
great. Grammatical grossness has a little bit more of a shrewdness to it when a little bit more wit.
That's right. But it illustrated a phenomenon I saw in several places that young students were proud of themselves and really enjoyed the formal study of grammar in isolation.
How long does it actually take, though, to teach students at elementary school or middle school level to get a good grasp of grammar? How long does it take?
Well, it's I'm just extrapolating from my own experience. It seems to me that the several years in grade school, fourth, fifth, sixth grades, seem to me to be the crucial years to get that basic conceptual understanding. I think it needs several years. I think it should be over an extended period of time, and it should go slowly, but that teachers should focus on the grammatical concepts themselves and not just teach them incidentally. Unfortunately, that's the conventional wisdom among English teachers now, is that grammar should be taught incidentally as part of writing exercises when it comes up. You say, oh, by the way, some people call that kind of word a participle. You know?
But you don't have the context that way of the whole structure.
Yeah. But it's not something you can get sort of intuitively if you're an avid reader. In other words, if I read great works of literature, I read Tolstoy, I read Federalist Papers, I read so many different writers, I'm not going to sort of absorb the rules of grammar?
Absolutely. Sure.
Because there are a lot of self-taught people, especially women in the past who were excluded from college, who write brilliant books with good grammar, where they never were given the sort of formal instruction or Latin.
Formal instruction. You're absolutely right. It can be overcome by voracious reading.
But it still, would it not help to know the names of the parts of speech? And wouldn't it be quicker to fix a sentence if you can say, instead of, well, something just doesn't kind of, you should change that word, you say, well, that's a noun-verb disagreement. That's why that sentence doesn't work.
Sure, sure. There's that. But to Emily's point, I'm reminded of the fact that the classical Greeks themselves didn't know anything about grammar. But they memorized huge swaths of poetry, and that was their education. They knew the Iliad and the Odyssey by heart. And if you do something like that, your grammar is fine.
However, how many people memorize any poetry, let alone huge swaths of it these days?
That would be my answer. I think that there are a lot of students like Emily that don't absolutely need formal isolated instruction in grammar because they are voracious and intelligent readers. And something like people who can play music by ear, not needing to learn.
Of course, how do you distinguish them in a class of 30?
Oh, and I didn't say I didn't need grammar. I said actually I felt cheated of not being given the right instruction because I think I came through when the fad was... Right. You know, you avoid grammar because it seems too prescriptive, too boring. It makes people not think of literature as an art form. Mm-hmm. I think that was probably the thinking.
Yeah.
And it is true that, literature is such a different kind of thing than math. Uh-huh. With math, you can learn certain rules, and people are trying to get the same answer, but that's not always true in the humanities, right?
That's true. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, the humanities is a reflective sort of enterprise. There really are no right answers for the most part. But grammar is a part of humanities where there are right answers and exact, precise definitions and so forth. And I think it's helpful for almost everybody. It's helpful for everybody, indispensable for most people, but not everybody.
And how can you make it fun? Give me a few examples of things you've done in a classroom if you had to teach grammar to resistant college students and you want to make it fun.
Well, I didn't succeed in making it fun for college students. I've seen it done. I guess there's a Milwaukee teacher. I forget the name of his school. It's an Episcopal school. Mr. Greitzmeyer, I think, and I'm sorry if I'm messing up his name, but he has an activity which is called verb tense football, where around the time of the Super Bowl every year, his class plays this, and they have a board with a football, and one player is on offense, and the defender gives him a verb tense like a future perfect progressive, and then the referee gives him a verb like a decapitate, and then he says, I will have been decapitating. And the referee says, that's right, and then moves up 10 yards. So, and they get very excited about that, and they know their verb tenses backwards and forwards, I'll tell you. So it doesn't take too much. But you do have this problem that older students who have been deprived of grammatical instruction are very deeply resistant to trying to catch up in college. I honestly don't know exactly. I don't know what to do about that.
Is the language, English language, and I mean, I think the French Academy fights this notoriously, but is the language tending to simplify over the years as you have more and more people who aren't studying the specifics of how it's supposed to be used? I mean, we lost the cases in English hundreds of years ago. Yeah, it used to be much more inflected.
Right. Well, there's natural evolution, which I guess tends toward simplification. What distresses me is what's exemplified by the Star-Spangled Banner anecdote. Just the tendency to simplify structure and to lose the ability to understand and to express complicated thoughts. Everything has to be a soundbite, you know. You can't...
Well, you do have to wonder how mass media are going to affect the use of English or any language.
I guess so.
When you think of texting, for example, which is without spelling rules, I mean, it has a few, I guess, without punctuation and without syntax, what's going to be left? And also without a very long arc of a thought.
Sure. And tweeting with 144 letter limit. Right. Yeah. I don't know whether those are causes or symptoms.
But it's certainly quite a contrast if you look at abbreviated speech today, in texting or whatever, compared to something like the first sentence of the Declaration of Independence. If you imagine trying to take that first sentence of the Declaration and reducing it to a text message.
That's right. Yeah.
That would be
a good exercise. But
Well, and I suppose another good place to apply what you know of grammar and the logic that comes out of it would be any kind of poetry. And text messages almost approach that at times. Mm. If something's telegraphic, what does this mean?
Yeah.
What is the verb? What is the subject? What is the object?
Yeah. Well, I wondered about that. The Renaissance was also the time of the printing press. And that facilitated the distribution of language. And yet it led to its better use and standardization. So
that's interesting. Yeah, sure.
Sure. So I wonder whether the internet, with the superior ability to communicate to more and more people in wider circles, why couldn't that lead to a renewed interest in eloquence and fine language? Doesn't seem to be heading in that direction.
I was just going to say, I don't see it in my, my emails anyway. Well, and then there's the modernists who seem to have such fun breaking rules deliberately, whether it's E.E. Cummings or James Joyce or others, where they will deliberately not use punctuation or make up words or, you know, take what seem prescriptive and limiting and break it wide open.
Of course, to be fair, E.E. Cummings, who broke all those rules also, was the person who said, "Warren G. Harding is dead. The only president who could make a simple declarative sentence with seven grammatical errors is dead." So he did have some pride in structure and grammar.
That's right. Well, I guess the modernists wouldn't have any appeal if the rules weren't there at all. If they, it's mostly by breaking rules that seem to have some importance.
But how would you diagram Gertrude Stein's "A rose is a rose is a rose"?
Funny you should mention Gertrude Stein. A rose is a rose. That's easy enough to diagram, as a matter of fact. But I guess I didn't get around to quoting her in the book. But she said that her favorite thing in school was diagramming sentences.
Yes, I read that too. She loved it.
Yeah,
but
right.
Perhaps, sort of fun.
Perhaps
right.
Again, just like with E.E. Cummings, knowing the rules, seeing the pattern, then gives you the freedom to experiment with it.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Well, the artist has to learn to draw a straight line before learning all the other things that are more personalized. Our guest helping us to learn some of the rules and the philosophy behind using them or breaking them has been David Mulroy, the author of The War Against Grammar. Thanks for being with us again.
Thank you very much.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.